phone ring. A bulky package was leaning against the door, left by a courier service. I tucked it under my arm and unlocked the door in haste, stepping over a pile of mail that had been shoved through the slot. I paused to snatch up the lot of it and scampered into the inner office, tossing the mail on my desk while I made a grab for the phone. I caught it on ring 5 and found Mary Bellflower on the line, sounding remarkably cheerful. "Did you get the documents Lowell Effinger messengered over to you? He sent me the same batch. Must be the package that was left at my door. I just now walked in and haven't had a chance to open it. What is it?" "The transcript of the deposition he took from the accident expert earlier this week. Call me as soon as you've read it." "Sure thing. You sound happy." "I'm curious at any rate. This is good stuff," she said. I shrugged off my jacket and tossed my shoulder bag on the floor beside my desk. Before I opened the packet, I walked down the short hall to my kitchenette and set up a pot of coffee. I'd forgotten to bring in a carton of milk, so I was forced to use 2 flat packets of fake stuff once the coffee had finished dripping into the carafe. I returned to my desk and opened the manila mailer. Then I leaned back in my swivel chair and put my feet on the edge of the desk, with the transcript opened on my lap, coffee cup to my right. Tilford Brannigan was a biomechanical expert who doubled, in this case, as the accident reconstructionist wearing 2 hats at once. The document was neatly typed. The pages were stapled together at the top left corner. Each 8x11 page had been reduced in size and formatted to fit 4 to the sheet. The first page listed correspondence, marked Plaintiff's Exhibits 6A through 6H, and went on down the numbered lines. Included was Brannigan's curriculum vitae, Gladys Fredrickson's medical summaries, request for production of documents, plaintiff response to the defendant request for production of documents, supplemental request for production of documents. Dr. Goldfarb's medical files had been subpoenaed, as had the files for Dr. Spaulding. There were numerous depositions, summary medical records marked Plaintiff's Exhibit Number 16, along with the police report. Various photographs of the damaged cars and the accident site had been entered as exhibits. I quickly flipped to the last page, just to get a feel for what I was in for. Brannigan's testimony started on page 6 and continued to page 133. The proceedings had begun at 4:30 p.m. and concluded at 7:15. A deposition is, by nature, a less formal proceeding than an appearance in court, since it occurs in a lawyer's office instead of a courtroom. Testimony is given under oath. Both plaintiffs' and defendants' attorneys and a court reporter are in attendance, but there's no judge. Hetty Buchwald was there representing the Fredricksons, and Lowell Effinger was on hand in Lisa Ray's behalf, though neither the plaintiffs nor the defendant were present. Years before, I'd looked up Ms. Buchwald's bona fides, convinced her law degree was from Harvard or Yale. Instead, she'd graduated from one of those Los Angeles law schools that self-promotes by way of big splashy ads pasted on freeway billboards. I cruised through the repetitious early pages where Ms. Buchwald worked to suggest that Brannigan was inexperienced and ill-qualified, neither of which was true. Lowell Effinger objected at intervals, mostly intoning, misstates the prior testimony, or asked and answered, in a voice that even on paper sounded bored and annoyed. Effinger had tagged certain pages to make sure I didn't miss the import. The gist of it was that, despite Ms. Buchwald's persistently snide and wearing questions that cast aspersions on him wherever possible, Tilford Brannigan was steadfast in his insistence that Gladys Fredrickson's injuries were inconsistent with the dynamics of the collision. There followed 14 pages of testimony in which Ms. Buchwald picked away at him, trying to get him to yield on whatever minor point she was pursuing. Brannigan held up well, patient and unperturbed. His responses were mild, sometimes amusing, which must have infuriated Ms. Buchwald, who relied on friction and animosity to rattle a witness. If he conceded the smallest detail, she leaped on the admission as though it were a major triumph, completely undermining testimony he'd given before. I wasn't sure whom she was trying to impress. As soon as I'd read the file, I called Mary Bellflower, who said, So, what did you think? I'm not sure. I know Gladys was injured. We have 3 inches of medical reports, x-ray results, treatment protocols, ultrasound, MRIs, x-rays. She might fake whiplash or lower back pain, but a cracked pelvis and 2 cracked ribs? Please. Brannigan didn't say she wasn't injured. He's saying the injuries weren't sustained in the accident. By the time Millard ran into Lisa Ray pulling out of the parking lot, she was already hurt. Brannigan didn't say so flat out, but that's his guess. What, like Millard beat the crap out of her or something like that? That's what we need to find out. But her injuries were fresh, right? I mean, this wasn't anything that happened weeks before. Right. It could have happened prior to their getting in the van. Maybe he was taking her to the emergency room and he saw his chance. Not to be dense about it, but why would he do that? He had liability insurance, but no collision coverage. They'd dropped their homeowner's policy because they couldn't afford the premiums. No catastrophic medical, no long-term disability. They were totally exposed. So he deliberately rammed into Lisa Ray's car? That's risky, isn't it? What if Lisa had been killed? For that matter, what if his wife had been killed? He wouldn't have been any worse off. Might have been better for him, actually. He could have sued for wrongful death or negligent homicide, half a dozen things. The point was to blame someone else and collect the dough instead of having to pay it out. He'd been badly injured himself, and a jury awarded him $680,000. They've probably pissed it all away. Jesus, that's cold. What kind of guy is he? Try desperate. Hetty Buchwald went after Brannigan tooth and nail and couldn't get him to back down. Lowell said it was all he could do not to bust out laughing. He thinks this is big, huge. We just have to figure out what it means. I'll go up there again. Maybe the neighbors know something we don't. Let's hope. I returned to the Fredricksons' neighborhood and started with the two neighbors directly across the street. Their knowledge, if any, probably wouldn't come to much, but at least I could rule them out. At the first house, the middle-aged woman who answered the door was pleasant, but professed to know nothing about the Fredricksons. When I explained the situation, she said she'd moved in 6 months before and preferred to keep her distance from her neighbors. That way, if I have a problem with any of them, I can complain without worrying about someone's feelings being hurt, she said. I tend to my affairs and expect them to tend to theirs. Well, I can see your point. I've had good luck with my neighbors until recently. When neighbors turn on you, there's nothing worse. Your home is supposed to be a refuge, not a fortified encampment in a war zone. Amen, I thought. I gave her my card and asked her to call me if she heard anything. Don't count on it, she said, as she closed the door. I went down her walkway and up the walk leading to the house next door. This time, the occupant was a man in his late 20s, thin face, glasses, underslung jaw, with a tiny goatee meant to give definition to his weak chin. He wore loose jeans and a t-shirt with horizontal stripes of the sort a mother would select. Kinsey Milhone, I said, holding out my hand. Julian Frisch. You selling something? Avon? Fuller Brush? I don't think they sell door-to-door these days. Again, I explained who I was and my fact-finding mission with regard to the Fredricksons. Are you acquainted with them? Sure. She does my books. You want to come in? I'd like that. His living room looked like a display for computer sales and service. Some of the equipment I could identify on sight. Keyboards and the monitors that looked like clunky television screens. There were 8 computers set up with tangled cables that snaked across the floor connecting them. In addition, there were sealed cartons I assumed contained brand new computers. The few cranky-looking models sitting in one corner might have come in for repair. I'd heard the terms floppy disk and boot up, but I didn't have a clue what they meant. I take it you sell or repair computers. A little bit of both. What do you have? A portable Smith Corona. He half-smiled, as if I were making a joke, and then he wagged a finger at me. Better catch up with reality. You're missing the boat. Time's gonna come when computers will do everything. I have trouble believing that. It just seems so unlikely. You're not a believer like the rest of us. The The day will come when 10-year-olds will master these machines, and you'll be at their mercy. That's a depressing thought. Don't say I didn't warn you. At any rate, that's probably not why you knocked on my door. True enough, I said. I redirected my attention and went through my introduction, which I'd just about perfected by then, wrapping up with a reference to the two-car collision on May 28th of the year before. How long has Gladys Fredrickson handled your books? The past 2 or 3 years. I only know her professionally, not personally. She's a mess right now, but she does good work. Did or does? Oh, she still handles my accounts. She complains about her aches and pains, but she never misses a beat. She told the insurance company she couldn't work because she can't sit for long periods and she can't concentrate. She said the same thing to me when I took her statement. His expression was pained. That's a pile of crap. I see the courier service over there 2 and 3 times a week. Are you sure about that? I work right here. I got a clear view across the street. I don't mean to rat her out, but she's as busy as ever. Maybe I was falling in love. My heart gave the same pitter-patter, and my chest felt warm. I put a hand across my forehead to see if I was suffering a fever of sudden onset. Hang on a minute. This is too good to believe. Would you mind repeating that on tape? I could do that, he said. I was thinking about firing her anyway. Her whining is getting on my nerves. I sat down on the lone metal folding chair and put my tape recorder on an unopened carton. I took out my clipboard so I could make a written record of the information as well. He didn't have tons to contribute, but what he offered was pure gold. Gladys Fredrickson's claims of disability were fraudulent. She hadn't collected a cent yet, unless she was receiving state disability checks, which was entirely possible. Once he'd gone through his account for the tape recorder, I packed up my gear and shook his hand, thanking him profusely. He said, "Not a problem. If you change your mind about becoming computer literate, you know where I am. I can get you up and running in no time." "How much?" "$10,000." "You lost me there. I don't want to pay $10,000 for something that makes me feel inadequate." I left thinking, 10-year-old kids? Get serious. The neighbor across the street to the right of the Fredricksons was no help at all. The woman never did quite grasp my purpose, thinking I was selling insurance, which she politely declined. I repeated myself twice and then thanked her and moved over to the house on the other side. The woman who answered the door was the same woman I'd seen when I arrived at the Fredrickson's house the first time. Given my experience with elderly persons, namely Gus, Henry, and the Sibs, I placed this woman in her early 80s. She was quick and soft-spoken and seemed to have all her faculties about her. She was also as plump as a pincushion, and she smelled of joy perfume. "I'm Letty Bowers," she said, as she shook my hand and invited me in. Her skin felt delicate and powdery, her palm 2 or 3 degrees warmer than my own. I wasn't sure she should be so trusting, inviting a stranger into her house, but it suited my purposes. Her living room was sparsely furnished, frothy curtains at the windows, faded carpet on the floor, faded paper on the walls. The Victorian-style furniture had a vaguely depressing air about it, which suggested it was authentic. The rocker I sat down in had a horsehair seat, which you couldn't get away with now. To the right of the front door, on the Fredrickson side of the house, French double doors opened onto a wood balcony crowded with flower pots. I explained who I was, and that I was working as an investigator on behalf of the insurance company Gladys Fredrickson was suing in the wake of her accident. "Would you mind if I ask you a few questions?" "Fine, I'm happy for the company. Would you like tea?" "No, thanks. I take it you're aware of the claim." "Oh, yes. She told me she was suing, and I said, 'Good for you. You should see the poor thing hobbling around. What happened was terrible, and she's entitled to recompense.'" "I don't know about that. These days, hitting up an insurance company is like going to Vegas to play the slot machines." "Exactly. All that money is paid in, and very little is paid out. The insurance companies as good as dare you to try to collect. They've got all the power on their side. If you win, they dump you or they double your premiums." This was discouraging, I had heard these sentiments expressed before, the belief that insurance companies were fat cats and the mice deserved anything they could get. In this case, the facts are in dispute, which is why I'm here. The facts are obvious. There was an accident. It's as simple as that. Gladys told me it was covered on their homeowner's policy, and the company had refused to pay. She said suing was the only way to force their hand. Auto. Auto? It's not their homeowner's policy. She's suing the company that carries the defendant's car insurance. Personally, I wondered if I was shooting myself in the foot. We were clearly working at cross purposes, but I got out my tape recorder and went through my drill, identifying myself, Letty Bowers, blah, blah, blah. Then I said, "How long have you known the Fredricksons? If you want the truth, I don't know them well, and I don't like them much. Am I under oath?" "No, ma'am, but it would be helpful if you could tell me what you know as truthfully as possible." "I always do that. I was raised that way." "I take it, Gladys, Fredrickson's talked to you about the accident?" "She didn't have to. I saw it." I leaned forward slightly. "You were at the intersection?" She seemed confused. "There wasn't any intersection. I was sitting right here, looking out the window." "I don't understand how you could have seen what went on." "I couldn't miss it. I do my pickup work by the window, which gives me good light and offers a nice view of the neighborhood. I used to do needlepoint, but lately I've gone back to knitting and crochet. Less strain on my eyes and easier on my hands. I'd been watching them at work, which is how I happened to see the tumble she took." "Gladys fell?" "Oh my, yes. It was entirely her fault, but the way she explained it to me, the insurance company will have to pay anyway if everything goes well." "Could we back up a few paragraphs and start this again?" I took a few minutes to go back over the lawsuit, filling in the details while she shook her head. "You must be talking about someone else. It didn't happen that way." "Fine, let's hear your side of it. I don't mean to sound judgmental, but she and her husband are penny pinchers, and they hate to hire help. The rain gutters were jammed with leaves. We'd had a number of spring storms, and the water had been pouring down in torrents, right over the edge instead of going into the downspouts. First week of nice weather, she got up on a ladder to clean the gutters, and the ladder toppled. She landed on the wooden deck, and the ladder came down and clumped her in the head. I was surprised she didn't break her back as much as she weighs. The sound was awful, like a bag of cement. I ran out, but she said she was all right. I could see she was woozy and limping badly, but she wouldn't accept help. Next thing I knew, Millard pulled the van around in front and honked. They had a heated discussion, and then she got in." "Did she tell you this in confidence?" "Not in so many words. She said it was just between the two of us, and then she gave me a wink. And here all this time, I thought the claim was legitimate." "Would you be willing to testify in the defendant's behalf?" "Of course. I don't approve of cheaters." "Nor do I." Late afternoon, as a special treat, I took myself up to Rosie's and ordered a glass of wine. I'd wait and eat when I got home, but I'd done a good day's work and I deserved a reward. I just settled into my favorite booth when Charlotte Snyder appeared. I hadn't seen her for weeks, since she and Henry had quarreled. I thought her presence was coincidental, but she paused in the doorway looking around, and when she spotted me, she headed straight for my table and sat down across from me. She had a scarf tied over her hair, which she removed and put in her coat pocket while she shook her hair back to its natural shape. Her cheeks were pink from the cold, and her eyes were bright. "I took a chance on catching you here when you didn't answer your door. If you tell me Henry's on his way, I'll disappear." "He's having dinner with William. It's boys' night out," I said. "What's up?" "I'm hoping to redeem myself in Henry's eyes. I heard the court appointed a woman named Christina Tassinato as Gus Vronsky's conservator." "Don't remind me. I was nearly sick when I heard." "That's what I wanted to talk about. According to the bank, she's taking out a big construction loan, putting the house up as collateral." "News to me. I gather she wants to remodel and upgrade, add a wheelchair ramp, redo electrical and plumbing, and generally bring the house up to snuff. The place could use a facelift. Even with the cleanup Solana's done, it's still a mess. What's the size of the loan? $250,000. Wow. Who told you? Jay Larkin, a friend of mine in the loan department. We used to date years ago, and he was a big help when I was getting into real estate. He knew I'd been interested in listing property, and when this came up, he assumed I'd made the deal. It struck me as curious because I told Solana the two parcels together were worth far more than the house. This block is already zoned multiple family. Any buyer with savvy would purchase both lots and tear the old house down. But it makes sense to remodel, with Gus so adamant about hanging on. That's just what I'm getting at. She put the house on the market. Well, maybe not Solana, but the conservator. For sale? How so? I haven't seen a sign out front. This is a pocket listing. I'm guessing she'll pay off the construction loan with the proceeds from the sale. I wouldn't have known about it, but an agent in our Santa Teresa office is handling the deal. She remembered I'd done comps when my client came through town, so she was calling to ask if I wanted a referral fee. I was sorely tempted, but with Henry so burned at me, I didn't dare. What's the asking price? $1,000,002, which is a joke. Even fixed up, it'll never sell for that. I thought it was odd, after Solana swore up and down Gus would rather die than part with the place. What I can't understand is why the house was listed with my company. Didn't anybody realize I'd get wind of it? The conservator probably had no idea you were ever involved, I said. Solana doesn't seem that sophisticated about real estate. If this is her doing, maybe she wasn't aware how closely you work with one another. Or maybe she's thumbing her nose at us. This is being done through Gus's bank, I asked. Sure, one big happy family, but the whole thing stinks. I thought you should know. I said, I wonder if there's any way to gum up the works. Charlotte pushed a piece of paper across the table. This is Jay's number at the bank. You can tell him we talked. Chapter 30. I slept poorly that night, my brain abuzz. Letty Bower's revelations had been a gift, but instead of feeling good, I was kicking myself for not interviewing her earlier. She and Julian both. If I'd talked to neighbors before my first meeting with the Fredricksons, I would have known what I was dealing with. I felt like I was slipping, distracted by the miscalculations I'd made in my dealings with Solana Rojas. Not to beat myself to death here, but Gus was in big trouble, and I was the one who'd put him there. What more could I do? I'd called the county, so there was no point in going over that ground again. Nancy Sullivan had doubtless drawn and quartered me in her report. Beyond that, I hadn't witnessed verbal, emotional, or physical abuse that warranted calling the police, which left me where? I couldn't persuade my mind to shut up. There was nothing I could do about any of it in the middle of the night, but I couldn't let it go. Finally, I sank into some deep canyon of sleep. It was like slipping into a trough in the ocean's floor, dark and silent, the weight of the water pinning me in place. I wasn't even aware I'd fallen asleep until I heard the noise. My leaden senses registered the sound and invented a few quick stories to account for it. None of them made sense. My eyes popped open. What was that? I checked the clock, as though noting the time would make a difference. 2:15. If I hear the cork pop from a champagne bottle, I automatically check the time, in case it turns out to be a gunshot, and I'll be asked later to file a police report. Someone was riding a skateboard in front of the house. Metal wheels on concrete. Repeated clicks as the skateboard rolled across cracks in the sidewalk. Back and forth. The sound surging and receding. I listened, trying to determine how many skateboarders there were. Only one, as far as I could tell. I could hear the kid try kickflips, the board slamming down when he made it, clattering off when he missed. I thought about Gus railing at the 2 9-year-olds on skateboards in December. He was at his crankiest back then, but at least he was on his feet. Despite his complaints and the nuisance calls he made, he was alive and vigorous. Now, he was failing, and no one else in the neighborhood was irritable enough to protest the racket outside. The board clacked and banged off the curb, into the street, back up on the curb again, and down the sidewalk. This was getting on my nerves. Maybe I'd be the cranky neighbor from now on. I pushed the covers aside and made my way across the carpeted loft in the dark. There was sufficient illumination from the plexiglass skylight above that I could see where I was going. Barefoot, I went down the spiral stairs, my oversized t-shirt leaving my bare knees exposed. It was cold in the studio, and I knew I'd need a coat if I went out to shake a fist, as Gus would have. I went into the downstairs bathroom and stepped into the fiberglass tub and shower surround, with its window that looked out on the street. I'd left the light off so I could see out without the skateboarder knowing I was there. The sound seemed farther away, muted but persistent. Then, silence. I waited, but I heard nothing. I crossed my arms for warmth and peered out at the dark. The street was empty and remained so. Finally, I climbed the spiral stairs again and crawled back into my bed. It was 2:25, and my body heat had dissipated, leaving me shivering. I pulled the covers over my shoulders and waited to get warm. Next thing I knew, it was 6 a.m., and time for my morning run. I started to feel more optimistic as I put away the miles. The beach, the damp air, the sun painting gauzy layers of color across the sky. Everything suggested this would be a better day. When I reached the Dolphin Fountain at the foot of State, I took a left and headed toward town. 10 blocks later, I made the turn and jogged back toward the beach. I didn't wear a watch, but I could time my progress as I reached the ding-ding-dinging signal gates near the train station. The ground began to vibrate, and I heard the train approach, its warning howl subdued in deference to the hour. Later in the day, when the passenger train came through, the horn would be loud enough to halt conversation up and down the beach. As a self-appointed site foreman, I took the opportunity to peek through the wooden barrier surrounding the new Paramount Hotel pool. Much of the construction debris was gone, and it looked as though the plaster coat had been sprayed over the gunite. I could imagine the completed project, deck chairs in place, tables with market umbrellas protecting the hotel patrons from the sun. The image faded, replaced by my worries about Gus. I debated putting a call through to Melanie in New York. The situation was distressing, and she'd blame me. For all I knew, Solana had already given her an annotated version of the story, appointing herself the good guy while I was the bad. Once I reached home, I went through my usual morning routine, and at 8 o'clock, I locked the studio and went out to my car. There was a black-and-white police cruiser parked at the curb directly across the street. A uniformed officer was deep in conversation with Solana Rojas. Both were looking in my direction. What now? My first thought was of Gus, but there was no ambulance and no fire department rescue vehicle on hand. Curious, I crossed the street. Is there a problem? Solana glanced at the officer and then pointedly at me before she turned her back and moved away. I knew, without being told, that the two of them had been discussing me, but to what end? I'm Officer Pierce, he said. Hi, how are you? I'm Kinsey Milhone. Neither of us offered to shake hands. I didn't know what he was doing here, but it wasn't to make friends. Pierce wasn't a beat officer I knew. He was tall, broad-shouldered, maybe 15 pounds overweight, with that staunch police presence that speaks of a well-trained professional. There was even something intimidating about the way his leather belt creaked when he moved. What's going on? Her car was vandalized. I followed his gaze, which had shifted to Solana's convertible parked 2 cars down from mine. Someone had taken a sharp instrument, a screwdriver or a chisel, and scratched the word dead in deep gouges on the driver's side door. The paint was stripped, and the metal had been dented by the force of the tool. Oh, wow. When did that happen?
Sometime between 6 o'clock last night when she parked the vehicle and 6:45 this morning. She caught a glimpse of someone passing the house and came out to check. Were you aware of any activity out here?
Over his shoulder, I saw that the neighbor from across the street had come out in her robe to get the paper, and she'd engaged Solana in much the same conversation I was having with the officer. I could tell from Solana's gestures she was agitated. I said, "That was probably me she saw this morning. Weekdays, I jog upstate, starting at 6:10 or so, and returning 30 minutes later. Anyone else out and about? Not that I saw, but I did hear a skateboarder in the middle of the night, which seemed odd. It was 2:15 because I remembered looking at the clock. Sounded like he was riding back and forth on the sidewalk, up the curb and down, some in the street. It went on so long, I got up to take a look, but I didn't see a soul. One of the other neighbors might have heard him. One kid or more? I'd say one. That's your place? The studio, yes. I rent from a gentleman named Henry Pitts, who occupies the main house. You can ask, but I don't think he'll be able to contribute much. His bedroom's on the ground floor rear, so he's not subjected to the same street noises that I catch upstairs. I was babbling, giving Pierce more information than he needed, but I couldn't help myself. When you heard the skateboarder, you came out to the street? Well, no, it was cold out and pitch dark, so I stood in my downstairs bathroom and looked out the window. He was gone by then, so I went back to bed. It's not like I heard him gouging and bashing away out here. I meant it as a bit of levity, but the look he turned on me was flat. You and your neighbor have a good relationship? Solana and me? Not really. I wouldn't go that far. You're on the outs? I guess you could put it that way. And what's that about? I waved the question aside, already at a loss for words. How was I supposed to summarize the weeks of covert cat and mouse we'd played? Long story, I said. I'd be happy to explain, but it would take a while, and it's irrelevant. The bad blood between you isn't relevant to what? I wouldn't call it bad blood. We've had our differences. I caught myself and turned to look at him. She's not suggesting I had anything to do with this.
A dispute between neighbors is serious business. It's not like you can walk away from the conflict when you live right next door.
Wait a minute. This is crazy. I'm a licensed investigator. Why would I risk a fine and county jail time to settle a personal dispute?
Any idea who might?
No, but it certainly wasn't me. What else could I say that wouldn't sound defensive? The mere suggestion of wrongdoing is sufficient to generate skepticism in the eyes of others. While we give lip service to presumed innocent, most of us are quick to presume quite the opposite, especially an officer of the law who's heard every possible variation on a theme. I should get on into work, I said. You need anything else from me? You have a number where you can be reached? I said, sure. I took a business card out of my wallet and passed it to him. I wanted to point and say, look, I'm a no-fooling PI and a law-abiding citizen, but that only put me in mind of the many times I'd crossed the law-abiding line this past week alone. I adjusted my shoulder bag and crossed to my car, acutely aware of the officer's eyes on me. When I dared to glance back, Solana was watching me as well, her expression poisonous. The neighbor standing next to her regarded me uneasily. She smiled and waved, perhaps worried that if she wasn't nice to me, I'd vandalize her car, too. I started the Mustang, and of course, when I backed up to pull out of the slot, I tapped the bumper of the car behind. It didn't seem sufficient to warrant getting out to look, but as surely as I didn't, I'd get dinged for thousands in repair work, plus an additional citation for leaving the scene of an accident. I opened the car door and left it ajar while I walked around to the back of my car. There wasn't any sign of damage, and when the officer walked over to see for himself, he seemed to agree.
You might be a little more careful.
I will. I am. I can leave a note if you think it's necessary. You see that? Fear of authority will reduce a grown woman to this kind of groveling, like I would have licked his belt buckle to a high shine if he'd grace me with a smile. Which he didn't. I managed to drive away without any further mishap, but I was rattled. I let myself into the office and put on a pot of coffee. I didn't need the caffeine, I was already wired.
What I needed was a game plan. When the coffee was done, I poured myself a mug and took it to my desk. Solana was setting me up. I had no doubt she'd scratched the car herself and then called the police. The move was a wily one in her campaign to establish my enmity. The more vengeful I appeared, the more innocent she looked by comparison. She'd already made a case for my calling the county hotline as a gesture of spite. Now I was a candidate for charges of vandalism. She'd have a hell of a time proving it, but the point was to damage my credibility. I had to find a way to counteract her strategy. If I could stay one step ahead of her, I might be able to beat her at her own game. I opened my bag, found the scrap of paper Charlotte had given me, and phoned the bank. When the call was picked up, I asked for Jay Larkin. "This is Larkin," he said. "Hi, Jay. My name is Kinsey Milhone. Charlotte Snyder gave me your number." "Right, absolutely. I know who you are. What can I do for you?" "Well, it's a long story, but I'll give you the condensed version." Whereupon I laid out an account of the situation in as succinct a manner as possible. When I finished, he said, "Not to worry. I appreciate the information. We'll take care of it." By the time I got back to my coffee, it was stone cold, but I was feeling better. I sat back in my swivel chair and put my feet up. I laced my hands on the top of my head and stared at the ceiling. Maybe I could put a stop to this woman yet. I've dealt with some very bad folks in my day, thugs, brute killers, and scamsters, with a number of truly evil people thrown into the mix. Solana Rojas was cunning, but I didn't think she was smarter than I was. "I may not have a college degree, but I'm blessed," she said modestly, "with a devious nature and an abundance of native intelligence. I'm willing to match wits with just about anyone. That being true, I could, therefore, match wits with her. I simply couldn't go about it in my usual blunt force fashion. Going head to head with her landed me where I was. From now on, I'd have to be subtle and every bit as cunning as she. Here's what else I thought. If you can't go through a barrier, find a way around. There had to be a crack in her armor somewhere." I sat up, put my feet on the floor, and opened the bottom right-hand desk drawer where I kept her file. There wasn't much in it: the contract with Melanie, the original job application, and the written report of what I'd learned about her. As it turned out, all the personal recommendations were horseshit, but I didn't know that then. I'd tucked Lana Sherman's resume at the back of the file, and I studied that now. Her comments about Solana Rojas had been hostile, but her criticisms only reinforced the notion that Solana was hard-working and conscientious. No hint of abusing the elderly for fun and profit. I placed Solana's application on the desk in front of me. It was clear I'd have to go back and fact-check every line, starting with the address she'd given out in Colgate. The first time I'd seen the street name, I had no idea where it was, but I realized I'd seen it since. Franklin ran parallel to Winslow, one block over from the 24-unit building Richard Compton owned. It was the Winslow property where the Guffies had so enjoyed themselves ripping out cabinets and demolishing the plumbing fixtures, thus generating their very own rendition of the flood, minus Noah's Ark. The neighborhood was a hotbed of low-life types, so it made sense that Solana would be comfortable in such a setting. I picked up my jacket and my shoulder bag and headed for my car. I pulled up across from the apartment building on Franklin, a drab, beige, three-story structure, free of architectural flourishes. No lintels, no windowsills, no shutters, no porches, and no landscaping, unless you find drought-tolerant dirt aesthetically pleasing. There was a pile of dead bushes near the curb, and that was the extent of the vegetation. The apartment number on Solana's application was 9. I locked my car and crossed the street. A cursory survey of the mailboxes suggested that this was a 20-unit complex. Judging from the numbered doors, apartment 9 was on the second floor. I made my way up the stairs, which consisted of iron risers with pebbly rectangular slabs of poured concrete forming the treads. At the top, I took a moment to reconsider. As nearly as I could tell, Solana was living at Gus's full-time. But if the Franklin address was still her permanent residence, she might come and go. If I ran into her, she'd know she was under scrutiny, which was not good. I returned to the ground floor, where I'd seen a white plastic sign on the door to apartment 1, indicating the manager was living on the premises. I knocked and waited. Eventually, a fellow opened the door. He was in his 50s, short and rotund, with pudgy features and a face that age had sucked into the collar of his shirt. The corners of his mouth were turned down, and he had a double chin that made his jaw look as formless and flat as a frog's. I said, "Hi, sorry to bother you, but I'm looking for Solana Rojas, and I wondered if she was still living here." In the background, I could hear someone call, "Norman, who's that?" Over his shoulder, he called, "Just a minute, Princess. I'm in a conversation here." "I know that," she called. "I asked who it was." To me, he said, "Nobody named Rojas in the building unless it's someone subletting, which we don't allow." "Norman, did you hear me?" "Come see for yourself. I can't be yelling back and forth like this. It's rude." A moment later, his wife appeared, also short and round, but 20 years younger, with a mop of dyed yellow hair. "She's looking for a woman named Solana Rojas." "We don't have a Rojas." "I told her the same thing. I thought it might be someone you knew." I looked at the application again. "This says apartment 9. Princess made a face. "Oh, her. The lady in 9 moved 3 weeks ago. Her and that lump of a son. But the name's not Rojas. It's Tassinato. She's Turkish or Greek, something of the kind."
"Christina Tassinato?"
"Costanza. And don't get us started. She left us with hundreds of dollars in damages we'll never recoup."
"How long did she live here?"
The two exchanged a look, and he said, "9 years. Maybe 10. She and her son were already tenants when I took over as the manager, and that was 2 years ago. I never had occasion to check her place until she was gone. The kid had kicked a big hole in the wall, which must have created a draft because she was using old newspapers as insulation, stuffed between the studs. The dates on the papers went back to 1978. A family of squirrels had taken up residence, and we're still trying to get them out."
Princess said,
"The building was sold 2 months ago, and the new owner raised the rent, which is why she moved. We've got tenants flocking off the premises like rats."
"She didn't leave a forwarding address?"
Norman shook his head. "Wish I could help you out, but she disappeared overnight. We went in and the place stunk so bad we had to have a crew that usually handles crime scenes come in."
Princess chimed in.
"Like if a body's been rotting on the floor for a week and the boards are soaked with that bubbly-looking scum?"
"Got it," I said. "Can you describe her?"
Norman was at a loss. "I don't know, average, kind of middle-aged, dark.
Glasses?"
"Don't think so. She might have worn them to read."
"Height? Weight?"
Princess said, "On the thin side. A little chunky through the middle, but not as big as me." She laughed. "The son, you couldn't miss. She called him Tiny, sometimes Tonto," Norman said. "Baby-faced, great big hulk of a guy."
"Real big," she said, "and not right in the head. He's mostly deaf, so he talked all in grunts. His mom acted like she understood him, but none of the rest of us did. He's an animal, prowling the neighborhood at night. Scared the crap out of me more than once."
Norman said, "Couple of women were attacked. He beat the shit out of this one gal, hurt her so bad she nearly had a nervous breakdown."
"Charming," I said. I thought about the goon I'd seen while I was cruising through Gus's house. Solana had been charging Gus's estate for the services of an orderly who might well be her kid. You wouldn't happen to have the tenant application she filled out when she moved in.
"You'd have to ask the new owner. The building's 30 years old. I know there's a bunch of boxes in storage from back when, but who knows what's in them."
"Why don't you give her Mr. Compton's phone number?"
Startled, I said, "Richard Compton?"
"Yeah, him.
He also owns that building across the alley. I do business with him all the time. I'll call and ask if he objects to my searching the old files. I'm sure he won't mind. In the meantime, if you hear from Ms. Tassinato, would you let me know? I took out a business card, which Norman read and then passed to his wife.
You think her and this Rojas woman are the same? She asked.
Looks that way to me.
She's a bad one. Sorry we can't tell you where she went.
Never mind. I know. Once the door was closed, I stood for a moment, relishing the information. Score one for me. Things were finally making sense. I'd done a background check on Solana Rojas, but in reality, I was dealing with someone else. First name Costanza or Cristina, last name Tassinato. At some point, there'd been a switch in ID, but I wasn't sure when. The real Solana Rojas might not even be aware that someone had borrowed her resume, her credentials, and her good name. When I returned to my car, there was a white Saab parked behind me, and a fellow was standing on the sidewalk, his hands in his pockets, looking at the Mustang with a discerning eye. He wore jeans and a tweed jacket with leather elbow patches, middle-aged, neatly clipped brown beard laced with gray, wide mouth, a mole near his nose, and another on his cheek.
This yours?
It is. Are you a fan?
Yes, ma'am. It's a hell of a car. You happy with it?
More or less. Are you in the market?
I might be.
He patted his jacket pocket, and I almost expected him to take out a pack of cigarettes or a business card.
Are you Kinsey Milhone by any chance?
Yes. Do I know you?
No, but I believe this is yours, he said,
offering a long white envelope with my name scrawled across the front. Puzzled, I took it, and he touched my arm, saying,
Baby, you've been served.
I felt my blood pressure drop, and my heart skipped a beat, my soul and my body neatly detached from one another, like cars in a freight train when the coupling's been pulled. I felt as if I were standing right next to myself, looking on. My hands were cold, but shook only slightly as I opened the envelope and removed the notice of hearing and temporary restraining order. The name of the person asking for protection was Solana Rojas. I was named as the person to be restrained. My sex, height, weight, hair color, home address, and other relevant facts neatly typed in. The information was more or less accurate, except for the weight, mine being 10 pounds less. The hearing had been scheduled for February 9th, Tuesday of the following week. In the meantime, under personal conduct orders, I was forbidden to harass, attack, strike, threaten, assault, hit, follow, stalk, destroy personal property, keep under surveillance, or block the movements of Solana Rojas. I was also ordered to stay at least 100 feet away from her, her home, and her vehicle. The low number of feet apparently taking into account the fact that I lived right next door. I was also forbidden to own, possess, have, buy, or try to buy, receive or try to receive, or in any other way, get a gun or a firearm. At the bottom of the paper in white letters on a block of black, it said, "This is a court order." Like I hadn't guessed as much. The process server watched me with curiosity as I shook my head. He was probably accustomed, as I was, to serving restraining orders on individuals in need of anger management classes. This is so bogus. I never did a thing to her. She's invented this shit.
That's what the hearing's for. You can tell the judge your side of it in court. Maybe he'll agree. In the meantime, I'd get a lawyer if I were you.
I have one.
In that case, best of luck. Pleasure doing business. You made it easy for me.
And with that, he got in his car and drove away. I unlocked the Mustang and got in. I sat, engine off, my hands resting on the steering wheel, while I stared out at the street. I glanced down at the restraining order I'd tossed on the passenger seat beside me. I picked it up and read it for the second time. Under court orders, in section 4, the box marked B had been checked, specifying that if I didn't obey these orders, I could be arrested and charged with a crime, in which case I might have to A, go to jail, B, pay a fine of up to $1,000, or C, both. None of these choices appealed to me. The bitch of it was she'd outmaneuvered me again. I'd thought I was so smart, and she was already one step ahead of me, which left me what? My options were now limited, but there had to be a way. On the way home, I stopped at a drugstore and picked up some 400 ASA color film. Then I drove back to my apartment and left my car in a weedy patch in the alleyway behind Henry's house. I slipped through a gap in the back fence and let myself into my studio. I went upstairs and cleared the surface of the footlocker I used as a bed table, setting the reading lamp, alarm clock, and a big stack of books on the floor. I opened the trunk and took out my 35mm single-lens reflex camera. It wasn't cutting-edge equipment, but it was all I had. I loaded the film and went down the spiral staircase. Now all I had to find was a vantage point that would allow me to fire off multiple views of my nemesis next door, making certain, at the same time, she didn't catch sight of me and call the police. Surreptitious picture-taking would certainly qualify as surveillance. When I told Henry what I was up to, he smiled impishly. "Your timing's good at any rate. I saw Solana driving off as I was coming back from my walk." It was his clever idea to use a flexible silver sunscreen against the windshield of his station wagon, which he insisted on my borrowing. Solana knew my car too well, and she'd be watching for me. He went out to the garage and came back with the screen he used to keep the interior temperatures down when he was parked in the sun. He cut a couple of nice, round, lens-sized holes in the material and handed me the car keys. I tucked the sunscreen under my arm and tossed it on the passenger seat before I backed the station wagon out of his garage. There was still no sign of Solana's car, though there was a handsome length of curb where she'd been parked earlier. I drove around the block and found a spot across the street, being careful to keep the requisite 100 feet between my person and hers, assuming she stayed where she belonged. Of course, if her parking spot was taken and she pulled her car in behind mine, I'd be jailbait for sure. I popped open the sunscreen and set it against the windshield, then positioned myself, camera in hand, and zeroed in on Gus's front door. I shifted my focus to the empty section of curb and adjusted the lens. I slouched down on my spine to wait, watching the front of the house through a narrow gap between the dashboard and the bottom of the screen. 26 minutes later, Solana turned the corner onto Albanil, half a block down the street. I watched her reclaim her parking place, probably feeling pleased with herself as she eased the car nose first into the space. I sat up and braced my arms on the steering wheel as Solana emerged. The click and whir of the camera were soothing as I shot frame after frame. She stopped in her tracks and her head came up. Uh-oh. I watched her survey the street, her body language suggesting her hypervigilance. Her gaze swept the block to the corner and then swung back and fixed on Henry's car. She stood and stared as though she could see me through the sunscreen. I shot 6 more frames, taking advantage of the moment, and then held my breath, waiting to see if she'd cross the street. I couldn't very well start the car and drive away without first removing the sunscreen, thus exposing myself to view. Even if I managed that, I'd have to pass right by her, and the game would be up. Chapter 31. Solana. Solana sat in the old man's kitchen, smoking one of Tiny's cigarettes, a guilty pleasure she allowed herself on rare occasions when she needed to concentrate. She'd poured herself a tot of vodka to sip while she counted and bundled up the cash she had amassed. Some was money she'd kept in a savings account, acquired over the years from other jobs. She had $30,000 that had been happily earning interest while she worked in her current position. She'd spent the past week selling off the jewelry she'd collected from Gus, as well as her prior clients. Some pieces she'd held for years, worried that the items might have been reported as stolen. She'd run an ad in the classified pages of the local paper, indicating a sale of estate jewelry, which sounded hoity-toity and refined. She'd had many calls from the bloodhounds who routinely combed that section, looking for a bargain born of someone else's desperation. She'd had the jewelry appraised, and she'd carefully calculated selling prices that would be tempting without generating questions about how she came by Edwardian and Art Deco diamond rings and bracelets by Cartier. Not that it was anybody's business, but she'd invented a number of stories. A rich husband who died and left her with nothing but the jewelry he'd given her over the years. A mother who'd smuggled the bracelets and rings out of Germany in 1939. A grandmother who'd fallen on hard times and had no choice but to sell the treasured heirloom necklaces and earrings she'd been given by her own mother years before. People liked sob stories. People paid more for an item with a tragedy attached. These personal accounts of hardship and yearning imbued the rings and bracelets, brooches and pendants, with a value that exceeded the gold content and the stones. She'd called the gallery owner every day for a week, asking if she'd located a buyer for the paintings. She suspected the woman was just putting her off, but she couldn't be sure. In any event, Solana couldn't afford to alienate her. She wanted the money. Gus's antique furniture she'd sold piece by piece to various high-end dealers around town. He spent his days in the living room or his bedroom and didn't seem to notice that the house was slowly being stripped. From those sales, she'd netted a little over $12,000, which was not as much as she'd hoped. Adding that sum to the $26,000 the old man still had tucked away in combined savings, plus the $250,000 she was borrowing from the local bank as a loan against the house, she'd have $288,000, plus the $30,000 in her private account. The $250,000 wasn't in her hands quite yet, but Mr. Larkin at the bank had told her the loan was approved, and it was only a matter now of picking up the check. Today, she had personal shopping to do, leaving Tiny to babysit Gus. Tiny and the old man got along well. They liked the same television shows. They shared the same thick pizzas, loaded with junk, and the plastic tubs of cheap cookies she bought at Trader Joe's. She'd taken lately to letting them smoke in the living room, though it annoyed her no end. They both were hard of hearing, and when the high volume on the TV started wearing on her nerves, she banished them to Tiny's room, where they could watch the old TV set she'd brought from the apartment. Unfortunately, living with the two of them had spoiled the joys of the house, which now felt small and claustrophobic. Mr. Vronsky insisted on keeping the thermostat set at 74 degrees, which made her feel as though she were suffocating. It was time to disappear. But she hadn't quite decided what to do with him. She packed the cash in a duffel that she kept in the back of her closet. Once she was dressed, she checked her reflection in the full-length mirror on the back of the bathroom door. She looked good. She was wearing a business suit, dark blue and plain, with a simple blouse underneath. She was a respectable woman, interested in settling her affairs. She took her purse and paused in the living room on her way to the front door. Tiny! She had to say his name twice because he and the old man were engrossed in a TV show. She picked up the remote and muted the volume on the set. He looked up with surprise, irritated at the interruption. She said, I'm going out. You stay here, do you understand me? Don't go anywhere. I'm counting on you to look after Mr. Vronsky and keep the door locked unless there's a fire. He said,
okay.
Don't answer the door to anyone. I want you here when I get back.
Okay.
And no backtalk. She took the freeway out to La Cuesta, to the shopping mall she liked. She was especially fond of Robinson's department store, where she bought her makeup, her clothing, and occasional household goods. Today, she was shopping for suitcases for her upcoming departure. She wanted new luggage, handsome and expensive, to mark the new life she was entering. It was almost like a trousseau, which she didn't think young women set much store by these days. Your trousseau was everything fresh, carefully assembled and packed before you left on your honeymoon. As she entered the store, there was a young woman coming out who held the door politely, allowing Solana to pass through. Solana glanced at her and then looked away, but not quickly enough. The woman's name was Peggy something, maybe Klein, she thought. The granddaughter of a patient Solana had cared for until she died. The Klein woman said, "Athena?" Solana ignored her and walked into the store, heading for the escalator. Instead of letting the matter drop, the woman followed her in, calling after her in a strident voice. "Wait just a minute. I know you. You're the woman who looked after my grandmother." She moved swiftly, hard on Solana's heels, grabbing at her arm. Solana turned on her savagely. "I don't know what you're talking about. My name is Solana Rojas." "Bullshit. You're Athena Melanagris. You stole thousands of dollars from us, and then you..." "You're mistaken. It must have been somebody else. I never laid eyes on you or anybody else in your family." "You fucking liar. My grandmother's name was Esther Feldkamp. She died 2 years ago. You raided her accounts, and you did worse, as you well know. My mother filed charges, but you were gone by then." "Get away from me. You're delusional. I'm a respectable woman. I've never stolen a cent from anyone." Solana got on the escalator and faced forward. The moving stairs carried her upward as the woman hung on to her from one step down. The Klein woman was saying, "Someone help! Call the police!" She sounded deranged, and others had turned to stare. "Shut up," Solana said. She turned and shoved her. The woman stumbled down another step and clung to Solana's arm like an octopus. At the top of the escalator, Solana tried to step away, but she ended up dragging the woman through the sportswear department. A clerk at the cash register watched with mounting concern as Solana took the Klein woman's fingers and pried them off one by one, bending her index finger back until she shrieked. Solana punched her once in the face, then shook herself free and hurried away. She tried not to run, because running would only call greater attention to herself, but she needed to put as much distance as she could between herself and her accuser. She was frantic to locate an exit, but there was no sign of one, which meant it was probably behind her somewhere. Briefly, she thought about finding a hiding place, one of the dressing rooms, perhaps, but she was worried she'd be trapped. Behind her, the Klein woman had persuaded the clerk to call security. She could see the two of them huddled together at the counter, while over the intercom, a voice intoned a store code that signified God knew what. Solana scurried around the corner where she spotted the down escalator. She held on to the moving rail and took the steps down two at a time. People opposite her on the up escalator turned to look at her idly, but they didn't seem to grasp the drama taking place. Solana looked behind her. The Klein woman had trailed her, and she was coming down the escalator steps at a pace that had her breathing down Solana's neck. At ground level, as the woman drew close, Solana hauled back with her purse, swinging it hard until it caught the woman on the side of her head. Instead of backing off, the woman grabbed the purse and gave it a yank. The two wrestled with the bag, which was now hanging open. The Klein woman snatched her wallet, and Solana yelled, "Thief!" A male customer in the men's department moved in their direction, uncertain whether the situation required intervention. Everyone was fearful these days, reluctant to get involved. Suppose one of the struggling parties had a gun, and a Good Samaritan was killed while trying to be of help. It was a stupid way to die, and no one wanted to take the chance. Solana kicked the Klein woman twice in the shins. She went down, crying in pain. The last flash Solana had of the woman, there was blood running down her legs. Solana moved away as swiftly as she could. The woman had her wallet, but she still had everything else she needed. House keys, car keys, compact. The wallet, she could do without. Thankfully, she carried no cash, but it wouldn't take the woman long to check the address listed on her driver's license. She should have left the other's address as it was, but it seemed wiser at the time to change it to the apartment where she herself had been living. Once before, she'd applied for a job, retaining the other's address instead of substituting her own. The patient's daughter had gone to the real address and knocked on the door. It didn't take a minute for her to realize the woman she was talking to was someone other than the woman who was caring for her aged mother. Solon had been forced to abandon that job, leaving behind additional precious cash she'd hidden in her room. Even the late-night trip back had netted her nothing, since the locks had been changed. She pictured the Klein woman talking to the police, weeping hysterically, and babbling the story of her Grammy and the larcenous companion hired to care for her. Solana didn't have a record, but Athena Melanagris had been arrested once for drug possession. Just her bad luck. If she'd known, she never would have borrowed the woman's identity. Solana knew complaints had been filed against her under her various aliases. If the Klein woman went to the police, the descriptions would add up. In the past, she'd left fingerprints behind. She knew now that was a terrible mistake. But it hadn't occurred to her until later that she should have wiped down each place thoroughly before she moved on. She hurried through the parking lot to her car and headed back to the freeway, taking the 101 south now to the Capillo off-ramp. The bank was downtown, and despite the upsetting incident at the store, she wanted her money in hand. Luggage she could buy somewhere else. Or maybe she wouldn't bother. Time was running short. When she reached the intersection of Anaconda and Floresta, she circled the block, making sure no one was following her. She parked and went into the bank. Mr. Larkin, the manager, greeted her warmly and showed her to his desk, where he seated her graciously, treating her like a queen. Life was like this with money. People fawning, bowing and scraping. She held her purse in her lap like a prize. It was an expensive designer bag, and she knew it made a good impression. Mr. Larkin said, "Will you excuse me for just one second? I have a phone call." "Of course." She watched him cross the bank lobby and disappear through a door. While she waited, she took out her compact and powdered her nose. She looked calm and confident, not like someone who'd just been attacked by a lunatic. Her hands were shaking, but she breathed deeply, working to appear nonchalant and unconcerned. She closed the compact. "Ms. Tassinato?" A woman had appeared behind her unannounced. Solana jumped, and the compact flew out of her hand. She watched the arc of its descent, time slowing as the plastic casing hit the marble floor and bounced once. The refillable disc popped out, and the hard circle of compressed powder broke into several pieces. The mirror in the lid of the compact shattered as well, and fragments littered the floor. The one shard of mirror that remained in the case looked like a dagger, pointed and sharp. She pushed the broken compact aside with her foot. Someone else would have to clean up the mess. A broken mirror was bad luck. Breaking anything was bad, but a mirror was the worst. "I'm sorry I startled you. I'll have someone take care of that. I don't want you cutting your hand."